Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Oklahoma's got its panhandle. Michigan has what looks like it ought to be part of Wisconsin. West Virginia's northern jut gives Ohio and Pennsylvania each an odd poke in the ribs. From coast to coast, American states have knobs and dangles and angles all over, and everyone tells a story. Some pretty important stories of kings and congressmen, slaves and gold rush. This hour, On Point, maps and mischief and history, how the states got their shapes. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Mark Stein. He's author of the new book, How the States Got the Shapes. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for having me.
So you looked up at that map on the wall and just couldn't stop thinking about it. You've gone state by state, and it really is a wonderful kind of march across the map. It makes you think about just how crazy some of these are. And there are big themes here, big chunks of history, and then just some odd bits of history. Take us into it, Mark. What, I don't know, just pick your state, your favorite story about some knob or angle. Start us down the way here.
Well, you know, maybe I'll start you off with what started me off. I grew up in Maryland, and every day in school, there I remember a big map of the United States and a big map of Maryland. And I believe it's a pretty accurate memory of seventh grade geography class, yet again, seeing those maps and thinking of Maryland, what is this thing? How did it get this shape? Particularly this, it's missing half a rectangle on the eastern end. What is that? And I discovered, when I looked, it's Delaware, and I remember thinking back then, do we really need Delaware? You know, I mean, Maryland wouldn't be that big if we had Delaware. Why do we have Delaware?
Okay, so it's one of the squiggliest shapes we've got going in this 50-state countdown. What about Maryland? You call it a sawed-off water squirt, water pistol look here. What left Maryland looking like that?
Yeah, I have to say, in fairness, that phrase is from the Wall Street Journal review. What I called Maryland in my book is the shape of human error.
Okay.
Because the colonial charter that created Maryland ended up in dispute with every border that Maryland had, and in every dispute, Maryland lost. Maryland was created as a Catholic colony, and in many of its disputes, early disputes, that informed the reason for boundary dispute, because you have to bear in mind that in those years, the 1600s, up in Massachusetts, they were burning people at the stake over religious issues. A king of England lost his head over religious issues. There were very, very violent fights and wars back then.
So how did religion end up taking a Delaware hunk or leaving that chewed? I mean, you've got the Chesapeake Bay and the Potomac River. You've already got a lot of pretty squiggly terrain here Maryland to deal with. But then, some odd squared off bits.
Yeah. What I more recently learned when I undertook this book with Delaware is that Delaware back then was actually colonized by Dutch settlers. I always thought of the Dutch around New York with Peter Stuyvesant, but it turns out that the Dutch claims in North America started down in Delaware at the Delaware Bay. They continued up the Delaware River. That's the river that goes through Philadelphia. It turns out to be the western boundary to this day of New Jersey. And then as far east as the Connecticut River through the middle of Connecticut and Massachusetts. So after the British ousted the Dutch from North America, Maryland said, hey, this should be part of Maryland. But the Dutch settlers said, oh, we don't want to be part of a Catholic state. They were Dutch Reformed Church. They were Protestant. So they resisted being part of Maryland. Believe it or not, Pennsylvania actually also exerted a claim to Delaware, even though it was nowhere in its charter, because without some control over Delaware, their access to the Atlantic Ocean could be cut off. You could cut off their access along the Delaware River while it was still narrow enough, and they couldn't get to the Delaware Bay. So there was a long, protracted negotiation. But the bottom line was that the king didn't want unnecessary headaches with these Dutch people living in Delaware. And so he did make them a separate entity from Maryland. And there actually was a loophole in the Maryland Charter that let him do that.
Mark Stein, look right next door to us. West Virginia has some of the oddest kind of horns and pokes and reaches here. It's got that sort of unicorn horn that sticks up between Ohio and Pennsylvania, and then that eastern sort of crook into the belly of Maryland. What are those about?
Yeah. Basically, there's two parts of history operating here. We'll start with that little nature of my mind, think of it as a little finger just sticking up, but I think jabbing the ribs that you used once is better. Up between Delaware and Pennsylvania. Between Ohio, Delaware on the brain, Ohio and Pennsylvania. Up until the Civil War, West Virginia was part of the state of Virginia. And that western squiggle, that part of that's sticking up in between the two states, Ohio and Pennsylvania, that's the Ohio River.
Mm-hmm. And Wheeling, very West Virginia up there, yep.
Yeah, very important river because it connects to the Mississippi and from the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico, the ocean. Before railroads in particular, but even after railroads, Virginia very much wanted to preserve its settlements and its land investments that it had made prior to the Revolution along the Ohio River. So up through to the Civil War, the western boundary of then Virginia would be the Ohio River. There was a very protracted struggle for where that western border of Pennsylvania would be after the Revolution. And when that was finally determined, they ended up with this little piece poking up because Virginia was really holding on to that Ohio River land. Now, those other squiggles sticking up under Maryland in that kind of crazy way it cuts through Virginia.
Along the Potomac there, yeah.
Well, actually, I'm talking about between Virginia and West Virginia.
Okay,
Departs the Potomac River. It's hard, I know, for listeners who don't have a map.
Well, you've got up against Maryland, it's following the Potomac. And then between West and Virginia and Virginia, that kind of looks like the stock market when it was on its way up there.
Yeah. What happened was is that throughout the history of Virginia from the Revolution to the Civil War, West Virginia was the western part of the state, I should say, was very, very unhappy camper because their mountainous area didn't lend itself to a slave economy, but slaves were counted in the apportionment for the legislature, so they were always getting the short end of the stick in the legislature. Mm-hmm. Several times they said to Virginia, "Let us break away," and Virginia said, "Over our dead body." Then Virginia seceded from the Union, and the western part of the state said, "Hey, we'll secede from Virginia. Now's the time." And so in October of 1861, a vote was held as to whether or not to secede from Virginia. But think about it. That vote could only be held in areas where the Union Army was there to protect them in that vote.
Right.
The Confederate Army wasn't going to do it. So what you've got in this boundary between Virginia and West Virginia are the counties where the Union Army was in occupation in October of 1861. It's a snapshot of 1 month in the Civil War.
And so forever, a boundary is made.
Yeah, voted to secede.
You've got a tale in here of Pennsylvania and Connecticut practically going to war over boundaries, and yet they're
not
even
practically.
Okay, tell us.
Yeah, no, it was a real war, and it was. Forts, cannons, you know, and plenty of casualties and death.
When? Where?
And,
over
yeah,
what?
And it's crazy because Connecticut and Pennsylvania are nowhere near each other. Back in those colonial charter days, the boundaries were often very different than they are today, and many of them extended technically to the Pacific Ocean. When Connecticut became a colony separate of Massachusetts, it inherited the western extents of what would have been then Massachusetts. So it technically went to the Pacific Ocean.
Well, all the way through the Rockies, no problem.
If it chose to, yeah. Now, there was that same loophole that involved the Dutch in Maryland that said, yeah, but it doesn't include land. This is the colonial charter. Doesn't include land currently under cultivation by Christians. That would be Dutch people when you come right down to it. Basically, the king was saying, you can't drag me into a war I don't want to get into. I'll pick and choose when. So after the Revolution, relatively little Connecticut, said, okay, well, we can't challenge New York and New Jersey. They were Dutch. We have no, but we want that, if you kind of follow little Connecticut all the way west, we want what would be our strip of what Pennsylvania says is theirs.
Bold.
And we want our strip of this so far undefined area that was soon to become Ohio, and they sent settlers. And Pennsylvania said, this is ours. And they had what was known as the Pennamite War. It lasted for well over a decade. You could travel in those regions, particularly up around, I believe, Wilkes-Barre, Scranton, and still see historical sites where the forts were, and many, many battles. And eventually the young United States government ruled against Connecticut. But even to this day, there's a vestige of what Connecticut had called in that era its Western Reserve in Cleveland, where we have Case Western Reserve University.
Wow. So a little remnant even now of what people went to war for then. Look up at that map on the wall, and you can see the footprints of history, though very often we don't know it. We're looking back at it in this hour with Mark Stein. He's written the new book, How the States Got Their Shapes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I want to go back to West Virginia. I want to go back to the one I love, where the skies are blue and the birds sing too. Take me back to West Virginia. They took me away from West Virginia.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the jigsaw puzzle of American states and how their boundaries got the way they are, why Oklahoma's got a panhandle, why Missouri has a boot heel, while Maryland's shaped like a squiggly squirt gun. Mark Stein is with us from Washington, D.C. His new book is How the States Got Their Shapes, and there's just no end to the stories here. Let's get the Oklahoma story, Mark, because everybody knows that famous panhandle, but I'm guessing a lot of people don't really know why it's there.
Yeah. Well, the Oklahoma Panhandle is really fascinating because the northern and southern boundaries of that panhandle tell both the story of, or they don't tell the story, but they're a vestige of the effort by Congress to regulate slavery in 1820, and then later in 1854, Congress surrendering that effort and washing its hands and saying from now on, the states will decide, and new states and territories will decide for themselves. And I'll get very specific with it. I should say, first off, it has nothing to do with Oklahoma. The southern boundary has to do with Texas, and the northern one has to do with Kansas. In the case of Texas, Texas entered the Union in 1846. It was an independent republic at that time. It had slavery. It actually was a much bigger republic than it is a state, and it extended far north up along the Rio Grande up to the 42nd parallel. But in order to maintain slavery...
Well, let's just hold on with that for a second. That's hard to visualize, but that's way up into Wyoming. It had a kind of a little, fat antenna sticking up there when
that's
it was a republic.
Right. I should say, I think I said 42nd parallel. What that is the northern border of California, Nevada, that part of Utah. That's the 42nd parallel. And back then, Texas kind of, although it tapered down pretty much, it followed the Rio Grande through New Mexico into southern Colorado and then some mountain crests all the way up to, in effect, as far up as California would go.
So how did slavery lines end up with Texas and Kansas giving Oklahoma this handle?
Yeah, well, in 1846, when Texas came into the Union, to stay a slave state, it had to abide by the Missouri Compromise from 1820. That was the federal effort to regulate slavery. And it said no new state or territory, with the exception of Missouri, that's the compromise, can have slavery if it is north of the southern border of Missouri at 36 degrees, 30 minutes. Mm. So Texas, in order to maintain slavery, said, okay, we will donate to the federal government all of our land north of 36 degrees, 30 minutes. And so to this day, that northern block there of Texas is at 36 degrees, 30 minutes.
So we so want to keep slavery that we'll give this slice to the federal government. Oklahoma can have it, whoever, and Oklahoma gets a handle.
Well, but not immediately, because at that point it was still just open, pretty much open territory there. But after Texas became a state, that actually led us into the Mexican War. And with the Mexican War, we acquired all this land in the Southwest, California, Arizona, New Mexico, much Colorado, Nevada, all that land. And the South realized that the Missouri Compromise wasn't going to work anymore. Too much of that land was north of 3630. So when Kansas came to the plate for statehood, there was a huge, huge fight in Congress over this slavery issue. And Congress ended up scrapping the Missouri Compromise and saying, look, from now on, we're not going to deal with the slavery question. Each new state or territory will decide for itself. And in fact, in the case of Kansas, it became such a violent issue, it was known as Bleeding Kansas. Mm-hmm. This is where John Brown mm-hmm. cut his teeth as a violent abolitionist. But as the dust settled, something else happened, or had happened, went very almost unnoticed. And that is that the original proposal for mm-hmm. Kansas statehood had a southern border right there against Texas, which makes sense there at 3630. Mm-hmm. But when the dust settled, the actual 1854 Kansas-Nebraska Act set the southern boundary of Kansas one half of 1 degree to the north at 37 degrees. So first of all, that created a gap, and that gap is the Oklahoma Panhandle. Why would Congress do this? Well, the answer starts to surface over the next 15 to 20 years when they create states in that area of the West. And what it shows is that they narrowed their focus, having eliminated slavery as one of the criteria for equality among the states. They took that off the board. Now they could be a little more mathematical with it. So they created the ability, and did in fact create, a tier of prairie states from Kansas to Canada, each having exactly 3 degrees of height. Kansas, Nebraska, South Dakota, North Dakota.
Stacked very neatly there, yeah.
Yeah. And at the same time, they created, just to the west, a tier of mountainous states. They didn't have quite as good agricultural land, so they gave them 4 degrees of height exactly. Well, I shouldn't say exactly. No, in this case, it is exactly. And that would be Colorado, Wyoming, and Montana.
Mm-hmm.
So that there was a clear foresight as to how they were going to try to preserve this quest, which existed from the Revolution on, of that all states should be created equal.
There was that gist, even though it didn't always work out in practice. Thomas Jefferson saw it. Himself. He looked at the center of the country and imagined something like equal states there.
Yes, after the Revolution, one of the things we acquired, in addition to the 13 colonies now being 13 states, was what they called the Northwest Territory. This was the land that the British had won before the Revolution with the colonists' help between the Mississippi and Ohio rivers, the kind of V form that today mm-hmm. is Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, a little bit of Minnesota. And Jefferson was charged with suggesting, how will we carve this up into states? His proposal had lines that Congress didn't follow, actually. And if you kind of look at where he's laying them out, it turns out they're all, as best as possible, 2 degrees high and 3 degrees wide. Well, Congress didn't stick with that, but they stuck with that principle that states should be created equal. And by equal, as Jefferson himself kind of demonstrated, that doesn't just mean square miles, but resources. How good is the land? What are the accesses to rivers and things like that?
But the people who were going to live there always had that very much in mind. Illinois looked at Lake Michigan and wanted more waterfront and ended up with it.
Yeah. Something very, very important happened from the time Jefferson laid out those proposed lines to the time that Congress carved out the actual states that I just named there in the Midwest. And that was that the Erie Canal became a feasible thing. And that changed lots of state borders because they weren't states yet, but as they became states, from those proposed territorial borders, it changed the actual state borders that they got, because the lakes were no longer just lakes, the Great Lakes. Now they were avenues of commerce, vital avenues of commerce to Lake Erie and the Erie Canal, to the Hudson River and the ocean. So Illinois got, it was supposed to be, in that case, a line from the southern tip of Lake Michigan that went east and west, so that Illinois and Indiana, down at the bottom of mm-hmm. Lake Michigan, would only have an infinitely small point of access to Lake Michigan. Illinois, for really interesting reasons, got 60 more miles up Lake Michigan. Indiana got 10. Well, they even made an adjustment to Ohio, even though it has a lot of frontage on Lake Erie, but a vital river that goes all through western Ohio called the Maumee empties into Lake Erie at Toledo. And Toledo, if that had been a straight line, would be in Michigan. So they put a little angular line for Ohio that included Toledo. Michigan, by the way, was so angry that it was still a territory, that its southern lands were being sort of, you know, taken.
Yeah.
That there was the fear that there would be a major bloodshed between the territories. And there was actually some violence called the Toledo War. And enough that Congress intervened and said to Michigan, hey, look, how about if we give you a consolation prize? We'll give you this peninsula of land up north. No one's really living, you know, white people anyway, living in that area to complain. And we'll give you that. What do you say? Michigan said, oh, we'll take it. So that's why.
Sort of tore the lid off what today is Wisconsin.
That's right. That's why Michigan has that upper peninsula that, hey, I went to the University of Wisconsin. You know, we're still a little agog.
That it's gone, and the 60 miles that Illinois tore away there on the Lake Michigan front? What's the story?
You know, when I was researching the book, I found a speech by a statehood delegate from Illinois, a man named Pope, arguing for this extra land. And he said about, I first read it, I thought, what is this man talking about? It was about.
This is from Chicago north, up toward Wisconsin's border.
That's right, up to just above, I believe it's Racine or Kenosha. I forget now the town that's right across the line. And he was saying how the importance of Illinois being connected to New York for the perpetuity of the Union. This is in 1813. He's talking about the perpetuity of the Union. And what I realized as I dug deeper was, first of all, the New York reference was the Erie Canal. Perpetuity of the Union was that if this Union, which as early as 1813, they already obviously must have feared that the South might at some point break away. And in Illinois, all the rivers except for one, the Chicago River, I think just about every other river flows to the Mississippi.
It'll be all about New Orleans and the South.
Exactly. They would be dependent on the South for their commerce to come in and go out via river. This is, again, keep in mind, 1813, before railroads were around. And he said, and the idea was that Illinois could build a series of canals so that if need be, the commerce all the way from central Illinois up through the rest of the state could be directed to Lake Michigan through this port at this little town that came to be called Chicago. And the extra 60 miles, when you look at a topographic map, that's the land that's still pretty flat before you get into those hills of southern Wisconsin left over from the glaciers. And they needed that, or so they claimed, to make it financially feasible for this system of canals.
National now, they never built geopolitics working there in a hurry to keep Illinois sewn in. You know, Mark, we've got so many listeners with questions and observations for you. I want to begin to turn to them. Let's go to Williamsville, New York. And Chuck, hi, Chuck, you're on the air.
Well, thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah.
My question deals with the New York-Pennsylvania border. You go straight across, and then also it takes a jog up north to take some land on borders of Lake Erie. So I was just curious how that came about.
Right. Well, there was quite a dispute between New York and Pennsylvania over where that boundary should be.
For listeners who aren't picturing it, this is to the northern border of Pennsylvania. You head straight west. It's just straight as can be. And then just before it gets to the lake, a little hitch up there to grab an extra bit of notch.
Right. The original colonial charter for Pennsylvania gave it a northern border at 43 degrees. Now, you know, what's that? Well, if you were to look at a map, you would find that 43 degrees is pretty much like Buffalo, New York.
Yeah.
And if you want to build an Erie Canal, you got to have Buffalo, New York, because that's why there's Buffalo, New York. So after the Revolution and when that canal was on the drawing boards and becoming feasible, New York realized we need this land.
No way we're giving that up, right?
Yeah, and they made the case, which is going to sound a little loopy, that way back for them, you know, in the 1600s, when Pennsylvania was created, some people interpreted a latitude not as a line, but as a band, and that therefore the line should really be 42 degrees.
Or a state of mind.
yeah. And why would Pennsylvania buy this argument? Well, they bought it because in Maryland's colonial charter, its northern border was right through Philadelphia. And the argument Pennsylvania used to get it moved down was, no, Used to be people called it a band. So they were hoisted on their own petard.
Yeah.
And they came to an agreement with New York that the line would be 42 degrees. But that Erie Canal was so vital now for, in this case, it would be the western part of Pennsylvania, that they needed a port to the Great Lakes. And so there was an exception made, which created this tab, Chuck, that you're asking about.
A little chimney down on the northwest corner.
Exactly right. And in the middle of that chimney is the town of Erie, Pennsylvania, which is a port, and got them access to Lake Erie so that they, too, could ship through the canal. Because otherwise, Pennsylvania is pretty much landlocked unless you get down to the southeast there at the Delaware River.
Let's get a call here from Baltimore. And Chris, hi, Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Listen, I shoot across Maryland every day. I drive for a living, and I'm always thinking about that small gap between Hagerstown and Hancock, Maryland, where it looks like Maryland's being pinched off kind of by West Virginia and Pennsylvania, and it makes me think about the Mason-Dixon line, which is strapped kind of going right across there. And I was wondering if your guest could talk about, you know, the surveyors and how they came to establish that line and how straight it is and the barriers of the mountains that they had to kind of, you know, they really had to plow their way through in order to establish the line as straight as it is.
Yeah, well, Chuck, Chris, let us look at it. And Maryland gets very, very skinny right out there just west of Hagerstown. What do you say, Mark?
Well, Chris has asked absolutely the perfect question at the perfect time because it follows Chuck's question to a T, because now we're talking about that other, quote, band of latitude between Maryland and Pennsylvania, that end of the dispute, where they had to come to some agreement as to where would that line finally be. And it's a really interesting story. It's one of the most bizarre stories on the map. Maryland's negotiations with Pennsylvania over that line were also part of Maryland's negotiations with Pennsylvania over Delaware. Because remember, I mentioned Pennsylvania; they wanted some control over Delaware so they couldn't get pinched off in their access to the Delaware Bay. So these were all lumped together, and they went on a very long time. And on one occasion, Lord Baltimore went to London to for these negotiations, and he found that on the Delaware front, that the Pennsylvania delegation was very amenable to his proposals. And he thought, this is great. If they're amenable to this, I'll take the proposal they have for the northern border, moving it, the one you're talking about, Chris, with Pennsylvania and Maryland. And they had a deal. When he got home, he realized his map was wrong in terms of Delaware, and it had located Cape Henlopen, which was to be the southern border of Delaware, 25 miles further south than it really is. Cape Henlopen is the southernmost point of the Delaware Bay. His map had it down at Fenwick Island, 25 miles to the south. And the northern border he had accepted so quickly, not really knowing where things were, turns out he almost cut his state in two where the Potomac River comes up.
Salvaged it just by a narrow strip there. Mark Steyn's new book is How the States Got Their Shapes. Here's Gene Autry with Oklahoma Hills. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Way down yonder in the Indian Nation, I rode my pony on the reservation in the Oklahoma Hills where I was born. Way down yonder in the Indian Nation, a cowboy's life is my occupation in the Oklahoma hills where I was born.
We're talking about the jigsaw puzzle of American states and how their boundaries got the way they are this hour. Mark Steyn is with us. He's the author of the new book, How the States Got Their Shapes. And there's a lot of history in them, their hills and boundaries. And we've got a call from Texarkana, Arkansas, and Ray. Hi, Ray. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I had a question about the state of Arkansas. To look at it on a map, it looks like there's a notch taken out of the southwest corner and another notch off the northeast corner. I was wondering how that came to be.
Yes, it sure does. They're very distinct. What about it, Mark Steyn? What about those notches in Arkansas?
Those two notches are well, I find everything interesting, I guess, but I think they're real interesting. They're from also two quite different points in history. Let me go chronologically. So we'll start on the southwest corner of Arkansas.
This is where Texas juts into Arkansas.
That's right. That's what that notch is. Yes, it's Texas, and it goes back to the Louisiana Purchase. If you read the document that conveyed that land to the United States when Thomas Jefferson made the purchase, it's wonderfully brief and clear. There's no legalese at all. But on the other hand, it doesn't state exactly what the boundaries are because no one really knew. Basically, it was as far west as a Frenchman could go without getting shot by a Spaniard and as far north without getting shot by a Brit, an Englishman. And so we had to negotiate with Spain and also with England to those borders. So that notch in the southwest that you're talking about,
along the Red River there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, is part of that negotiation. And the upper part of the notch is the Red River.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the bottom part of the notch is a part of a straight line, goes down beyond Arkansas and connects to the Sabine River. And
down along Louisiana's western border there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what it really was doing, you don't really see it on a map of the states, but the Red River doesn't stop at the notch the way the map kind of stops at the notch. The Red River continues on through Louisiana, doesn't really connect to the Mississippi, goes down to the Gulf. It was a very important river that early, 1803, I believe, for commerce. So they were dividing the Red River at what they believed then to be its midpoint. That's the point of the notch, the corner of the notch,
mm-hmm.
And then they were also doing going south for a similar dispute that they were trying to resolve with the Sabine River, and that's the curve of Texas' eastern mm-hmm. boundary that mm-hmm. we sort of see in Louisiana, Texas. So that's that southwest notch.
Now, when you look up in the northeast, and here you've got this sort of boot heel of Missouri that sticks down into Arkansas along of course, Tennessee and the Mississippi River are right up against Arkansas there on its eastern border. But what is this? There's an earthquake at the heart of this story about the Missouri boot heel.
There is, and I like to think of that boot heel in Missouri as embedded in the shape of our states, the fact that America really is the land of opportunity. Back in 1811, there was a terrible earthquake in that boot heel region, and many of the residents decided to pack up, sell their land, and go. And there was a young fellow there, he was only 17 years old, named John Hardiman Walker, and he realized that he could buy some land at, like, rock-bottom prices, and he started doing it. By the time Missouri came to apply for statehood in 1820, Walker had become so wealthy and powerful, he was known as the Czar of the St. Francis River Valley. And he could see that the proposals for Missouri statehood would put his land, the holdings, in below Missouri, in what later became Arkansas. But he also knew that the real powerful state in that region would be the state that possessed not only the Mississippi River, but the Missouri River, and particularly the confluence of those rivers at St. Louis. He wanted to be in Missouri. So he exerted his influence to get Congress to make an exception to a line that, you know, little adjustments, but basically to a line that goes all the way from North Carolina, Virginia, mm-hmm. through Kentucky, Tennessee, and as was happening then, Missouri, Arkansas, they made a pretty big adjustment and gave him this, what we now see is this boot heel digging down into Arkansas. It's really the result of one man's power.
Between the St. Francis River and the Mississippi, have an earthquake, empty the countryside, buy it up, and buy your way into the state of your choosing.
That's right.
There's another amazing little piece of geography and map drawing down here, just south of New Madrid. We've got a local historian, Lynn Bach, who joins us from New Madrid, Missouri. Lynn, are you there?
Yes, Tom.
Lynn, describe this little bit of Kentucky that's out like a dollop of Kentucky entirely cut off from the rest of the state that's just south of where you are now.
Right. It's across the Mississippi River for me. It's in the very southwestern edge of Kentucky. It looks kind of like a slightly deflated balloon, and it's bounded on three sides by the Mississippi River and on the southern border with Tennessee.
Doesn't the kind of Oxbow Bend in the Mississippi, a little practically island of land in the middle of it. It's surrounded by a lot of Missouri. It's cut off from Kentucky. How did it happen, Lynn, that this little dollop got sawed away from the rest of Kentucky?
The story is that the Kentucky claimed the land to the western border of the Mississippi River, and the surveyor got to the first western border and stopped. And that was going to be the end of the state of Kentucky. And the people who lived over in Madrid Bend or Bessie Bend or even Kentucky Bend, they decided that they wanted to be part of the newly formed Commonwealth. And so what they did is they went over and got the surveyor, brought him over to the bend, apparently had a party of some sort, and the story is they served him a little bit of Kentucky bourbon whiskey and got him to include that part into the state of Kentucky.
Mark Stein, have you followed this in? What about the role of a little bourbon whiskey in drawing boundaries?
I'll tell you, this might be the first example where there could be some truth to it. I know I heard a story about that with the southwestern corner of North Carolina, that they wanted whiskey so bad they took a beeline away from their route and went to Georgia and called it the state line. But I didn't believe it because there was so much moonshine that. And they kept it in their journals about the moonshine they were buying. But this one, this could well be, because that boundary was to go to the Mississippi. And I could see the argument made by the surveyor to stop when he first hit the Mississippi. And I could see the case being made that they should go all the way to the farthest western boundary of that crazy looping Mississippi there.
Right, and Tennessee actually disputed the claim up until the 1840s and finally dropped it.
Do those Kentuckians get a little lonely out there in their little dollop in the midst of Missouri, Lynn?
Well, there's about 17 people that live over there now. and, you know, borders are really kind of like dotted lines on a map. They're closely connected with the people over in Tennessee. They have to drive through Tennessee to, let's say, renew their license plates on their car, or if they want a sheriff, a deputy, he has to drive through Tennessee to get there. The children actually go to school in Tennessee. They have an agreement, so it's not all that lonely.
Yeah.
Mark Twain did tell a story about that little area, though.
Mm-hmm.
The line was called Compromise, and there were two families that were feuding, one in Tennessee and one in Kentucky, and there was a church located on the line, and each family would come in the same door and leave through the same door, but one would sit in Kentucky side of the church and the other would sit on the Tennessee side of the church.
That's great. Even Mark Twain following the little dollop in the state lines right there. Lynn Bach in New Madrid, thanks very much for being with us.
Sure.
Let's get a call from New Britain, Connecticut. And Mark, hi, Mark, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
This is also Mark Stein.
Mark Stein, meet Mark Stein. We hope the universe doesn't implode. Okay.
Yeah. Funny thing happened on the way. Listen, I know you're getting a lot of notch stories. I'm just going to check one more out of the pile. This one may be a little picky, though. Here in Connecticut, on our northern border with Massachusetts, the border is perfectly straight, except for a little square projection of the town of Southwick, Massachusetts, which comes up against Granby and East Granby in Connecticut. Now, I have no idea how that notch came into being, and perhaps it's come to your attention, Mr. Stein, and perhaps not. But there's an amusing little story about it. Our former disgraced governor, John Rowland, before he met his political demise, had a sort of an April Fool's Day proclamation one year that he was going to send the Connecticut First Governor's Foot Guard, a ceremonial unit in colonial-era dress, to invade Southwick, take back the notch, thus straightening the Connecticut border and allowing Massachusetts to slide off into the sea.
Okay. Cut away the notch and off it might go. Mark Stein, for Mark Stein, what about that? Here's this little funny bit of Massachusetts that tips down into Connecticut. It is, in fact, not the only notch. And you do explain the relation here.
Yeah. It's not trivial at all. That's called the Southwick Jog. The governor would have not had legal documents behind them because it was very, very much a documented agreement. When Connecticut started to form its own colonies. This is really early in colonial history. There was question as when they became their own colony where their boundary would be with their parent colony of Massachusetts. It's complicated by the fact that Massachusetts doesn't have a clear colonial charter because it is the amalgam of two colonies, the Plymouth Colony and the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Mm. So there was some question with that. And the other issue was that, and this is what really led to the jog, was that there were settlements in Massachusetts people in the area that Connecticut wanted to make its northern border, the towns of Enfield, Woodstock. I'm not going to be able to remember the other two at the moment. And there was quite a dispute between the two colonies. One way that the way that they finally resolved it was that they set that straight line mark that you referred to, that's basically the Connecticut-Massachusetts border, where it is, and those towns became Connecticut towns. By the way, they wanted to be Connecticut towns because of lower taxes, of all things. And in return, Connecticut said to Massachusetts, we will give you a hunk of land attached over there by Southwick and Congammon Lakes, and that will be to compensate for the land we're getting by this location of the line where it is. Now, there was a formula they were using that had a certain amount of logic to it for where that line is, but still they had to compensate, they felt, for this loss of these settlements. So that's why there is the Southwick jog of Massachusetts into what you might like to think of as Connecticut.
A little dip along the Connecticut River, a little jog out by the lakes, and there's another interesting just clipped-off corner of Massachusetts all the way out in the very southwest, which got rid of a kind of bandit's hideout. Got it out of Massachusetts' hair. What happened there?
Yeah. And part of what happened there also, Massachusetts, I'll tell you in one moment why, in the 1850s, agreed to snip off its southwest corner and give it to New York. And I should point out that once you become a state, you cannot have your boundaries changed without your consent. And that doesn't happen too often. But this is one of the very few instances where a state actually consented to have its border changed. In that southwest corner, if you look at old maps of Massachusetts, you'll see it comes to a point. And after 1850, you'll see there's this snip. You're way up in the Berkshire Mountains there. There still is a little town called Boston Corner. The only roads, even today, to Boston Corner are from New York or Connecticut. So Massachusetts had a very hard time enforcing the law in this little town because they'd have to go all the way around, either through Connecticut or New York. And therefore, it became a haven for lawlessness, quite a den of vice. So in the 1850s, they agreed to New York. Neither state liked what was going on there.
Here, you take it.
Snip it off. You bet. And New York said, we'll take it. We'll clean it up. And they did. You have this little snip off the end of Massachusetts in the southwest corner.
Let's get one more call. Josh in Dedham, Massachusetts. Josh, our time is short. What do you know?
Point Roberts in Washington State was cut off from the country by water and the 49th parallel.
Yeah.
It's a little peninsula.
Yeah.
I thought that was
yeah.
kind of interesting. I read about that.
Yeah, yeah. Very much the same kind of thing as that town we were just talking about in Kentucky, where it simply was extending the agreed upon border and as a result having this sort of isolated tip of a kind of peninsula be part of the original jurisdiction. Just in general, I point out that in many of the other cases when the boundaries were fixed for a state, they would make exceptions so that you did not have those isolated islands of jurisdiction. But sometimes, for one reason or another, they wanted to keep that land, and so they did, yeah.
And then, of course, the giants, California and Texas, we've scarcely time to touch on them, but there were proposals along the way to break them up. Texas could have been five states and would have changed the electoral map of this country dramatically, but they were so big, had such a sense of their own identity, they didn't want to be five states.
Yeah.
They remained Texas.
Yeah, yeah. I think the interesting thing to me about Texas and California is, I talk about this principle that all states should be created equal. Congress didn't create Texas, and Congress didn't create California. They created themselves. Real quickly, in this case of Texas, it had been a republic.
Sure.
It was very important to us politically in terms of our expansion when they gave us the opportunity to have them join the union. So although we said you could have five, as many as five states, we had to accept the fact that because they were so bound together by their own history, they didn't. California followed about 3 years later, and because of the gold rush. Within 12 months of getting that land from the Mexican War, gold was discovered. So many people went to California. They formed their own government. They presented these boundaries as pretty much a take-it-or-leave-it proposition. There's a quote in the book from Senator William Seward about why we have no choice but to take it, and we did.
That if we didn't take California as a state, it might become its own country. And with what would be the Western United States would come under the orbit of another power entirely. Some might say it almost happened that way anyway with all everything in California. Mark Stein, it's been wonderful going across the map with you. The new book is How the States Got Their Shapes. Thanks for all your work. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Mark Stein in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go out with Woody Guthrie.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.